Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, December 4th, 2010. I'm Marcia Mary Baker. Our topic today is Glass-Steagall or Die, the Principle of Production, the Case of Agriculture. And we're actually going to take it somewhat in what appears to be that order. In this sense, I'm very glad to have in the studio live for discussion today Tony Papert. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, good to be here.
Who is with the Executive Intelligence Review Editorial Board, besides other things, and he is preparing a summary of where we stand in this rapid ongoing battle on the financial blowout, the situation in Ireland, but really the fact of the InterAlpha Group financial imperium blowing out, and that will be in EIR Online, which is posted on or about December 7th. And the second part of the program was pre-taped just a couple days ago, December 2nd, when we had the opportunity to have in the studio a longtime activist farmer from Iowa, Richard Baker, to give a backgrounder on decades of disorganization or destructuring of the farm belt in the United States, which really makes the point that while we're talking about the chain reactions of financial and monetary system disintegration, it's the physical economic condition of the planet that's at stake. You can't take food capacity for production for granted. You can't. We have the resurgence and spread of disease. Look at the situation of cholera in Haiti. It's a terrible part of a generalized picture of what's happening around the world. So this kind of breakdown I just mentioned, though, is not a mistake. It's the actual agenda of this group, imperialist monetarist grouping. They've been doing all kinds of financial looting all along for decades, specialists at it, these banks, since they and under such rubrics as free trade and all this kind of thing. But that whole web is bankrupt. And so that's why we want an update today. We're actually in the process of a blitz attempt of engaging people to understand the real nature of the principle of production as how to look at what kind of credit system we need to have on an emergency basis. That was the principle of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act in banking. And that's the vantage point from what we have to have today. Now, I just throw in this kind of announcement and then turn right to Tony, is that we have a lot of activities when I say we're trying to engage people. We have two conferences. It's not the Executive Intelligence Review, but our people are participating in it on the emergency situation and also what we should be doing, the North American Water and Power Alliance. It's out in Pasadena, California. There's one in Kennewick in the eastern Washington. Associates, friends of Mr. LaRouche in Germany are having a party conference, I think, in Frankfurt today. Right now. And Harley Schlanger, whom you all know from this show and in many other respects, is there in person. So anyway, that's the point. We need people's support. We need people's activation. And it is a pitch battle. And with that, Tony, why don't you begin? You'll probably begin on the transatlantic front, but in terms of what's going on with the InterAlpha gang.
Well, as some listeners probably know, a little-noticed provision of the Dodd-Frank or Dudd-Frank financial reform bill, which became law a few months ago, which was stuck in by Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who basically traded this off for a fuller audit of the Fed. But he got a provision in there that forced the Fed to reveal all the participants in their secret emergency bailout loans, basically in 2008. The Fed made available on December 1st transaction records for 21,000 of these loans, amounting, I believe, to about $16 trillion. Now, they had argued extensively before that this could not be released. It would hurt this. It would hurt that. It would screw things up. But nevertheless, they did it. And there were a great many surprises in that among that 16 trillion of bailout loans that they loaned not only to Wall Street banks, as everybody had known, but also to wealthy individuals, hedge fund owners. They loaned to McDonald's Corporation. They loaned to all kinds of companies. But the biggest surprise was that the largest categories of loans in several of their large programs were not U.S., but foreign banks. And this completely shocked most people who found out about it, most certainly most Americans. The one of their programs was called the Term Auction Facility. Biggest recipient of funds from the Term Auction Facility was Barclays Bank of London. The other top users of the Term Auction Facility were Royal Bank of Scotland, Societe Generale, Royal Bank of Scotland, again of Britain, Societe Generale of Paris, Dresdner Bank of Germany, Bayerische Landesbank Dexia of Belgium, Santander. Actually, the biggest participant in the commercial paper program was UBS, the Swiss giant, Union Bank, formerly called Union Bank of Switzerland. So the whole bailout, contrary to what anybody thought and anybody from the Fed said, the Fed, Obama, who was in on this later, Paulson, and Geithner, who was directly administering it as head of the New York Fed at that time. Contrary to anything they had said, they were predominantly bailing out foreign financial institutions, not U.S. institutions. Why? Just to, I guess, reinforce that point, Frank Partnoy, who, despite his name, is a big expert in this area and a San Diego law professor, did an analysis of the whole dump on the third, and said the Fed's new data, the data I spoke about, show it was well aware of the crisis and had the ability to lend tens of billions of dollars, but it opted to lend primarily to non-U.S. banks. So we were bailing out non-U.S. banks, the American taxpayer, with most of his $16 trillion, and it was not. And it was European banks and predominantly, or by no means exclusively, British banks. So, what is going on? What's going on, and as Marsh alluded to this before, is that the center of this rotten world financial system, which is now collapsing, is something called the Interalpha Group of Banks, which was set up in 1971 at precisely the same time that the fixed exchange rate system set up by Roosevelt in 1944 was being destroyed and shut down by Richard Nixon, advised by George Shultz and others. The purpose, as we've chronicled, and you can get this particularly on the as I you I know you can get it on the LaRouche Pub EIR website, where this show is being shown, but the purpose of that Interalpha Group, it was set up by Lord Jacob Rothschild, who's kind of a chief executive agent for the British Empire of the monarchy, of the British monarchy. He was behind setting up this group. It's a consortium of banks covering all European countries, weighted toward Britain. And the purpose in setting it up precisely in 71, when Roosevelt's fixed exchange rate system was being shut down, was to set up a substitute world monetary system as part of the City of London British monarchy, the current form of the British Empire as a financial empire, not so much a colonial empire, but a financial empire. They set up a group of banks which were, and their explicit purpose, this we've documented, this is really not an inference. What they said is that we're entering a new world order of floating exchange rates, which they had manipulated into existence in various ways and finally got Nixon, who was a real crumb bum, to put through. We're setting up a new world monetary system, and these banks will function in the center of it as it develops. We're going to run it. And they have run it. And in the course of running it, they've run it into the ground. They've run themselves into the ground. They're all bankrupt. They're leading bankrupts. So the secret behind every day's news of financial collapse is the desperate effort at this point to conceal or postpone or in some way smooth over, pave over the total bankruptcy of this group of banks.
Yeah, so
it's
when
going
you hear about
today,
Greece or Spain or Ireland,
yes,
or the U.S. in 2008,
exactly.
We were told to save the nation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We were told to save the nation. Exactly. We were told to save the nation. Now we're told that Bernanke's program of quantitative easing, where he says, you know, as a start, he's going to buy $600 billion worth of treasuries and other notes by printing money. We're told that's to create jobs. Baloney. It's nothing to do with create jobs. It's to bail out, to pave over, to somehow conceal the bankruptcy of this inter-alpha group at the center of the present floating rate system, conceal their bankruptcy for a few more days. That's what's going on. And Royal Bank of Scotland, which was one of the main receivers of the Fed funds, is part of that group, as is Societe Generale, again, top of the list on the receiver of these Fed bailout funds. Now, precisely the same thing is what's going on, as Marcia said, about Greece, Spain, Portugal, most immediately Ireland. And this is where the whole program can and should come to a sudden end right away, because the Irish are not putting up with this. The Irish are being told, dictated by a supposed committee of various committees of predominantly continental Europeans, supposedly, the European Central Bank, the European Monetary Union, the IMF, they're being told that they must get a big loan, but this is nothing but a cover. What they're being told is that they must extract from the hides of the Irish people about 14 billion euros, which is, say, maybe roughly off the top of my head, $17 billion or something of that sort. They must take out of the hides of the Irish $17 billion over the next 4 years to bail out so-called the Irish banks. But what are these Irish banks? They're not Irish banks. They're the inter-alpha banks led by the Allied Irish Bank, which is going to be the biggest recipient of this ripoff if it's allowed to go through. There again, they're being told, pull, you know, I said $17 billion, let's say, out of the hides of the Irish people over the next 4 years, having already pulled $17 billion out of the hides of the Irish people over the last 2 years in order to bail out these banks. This program, if it's permitted to go into effect, will deprive every Irish family or the average Irish family of 10% of its current income per year by the last year of the program, 2014, which, of course, if that goes through, none of us will live to see that.
Yeah, and I hear the government functioning measured in different things that are done, everything to water systems, to social workers, to police, are to be cut by a straight 10% right off the bat. It's like people are looking in the United States at Camden, New Jersey, basically being shut down.
Cut unemployment, cut pensions, and impose hosts of new taxes on average Irish people, you know, of average income. At present, about 45% of Irish families are considered too poor to pay income tax. They're all going to be paying income tax. At present, they're not paying for their water. It's provided as a service. They're going to pay for water. At present, they're not paying a tax on their homes. Every home in Ireland will be taxed under this.
On your cottage, your potato patch.
Yeah, exactly. Every home in Ireland will be taxed by the federal government under this program. So all in all, it will deprive them, having already deprived them of 10% of their income over the past 2 years in an unsuccessful effort to protect these banks from the consequences of their own folly, it's going to take another 10% of their income over the next 4 years in a vain attempt, because the inter-alpha group is going to go bankrupt either way. None of this will help. But in a vain attempt to save them from bankruptcy, it'll extract another 10% of incomes from the average Irishman. Now, the Irish, as many of our listeners know, the Irish have a unique character among European people, which is closely linked to the character of Americans. I mean, and the Irish struggle against the British Empire for centuries, about the same time that we began our fight against the British Empire, the Irish began theirs. They didn't really complete it until the 20th century, but they began around the same time in close cooperation with Benjamin Franklin and others of our founding fathers here. The Irish are not about to put up with this. And the one party in Ireland which up to this point has said flatly, no, throw this program out the window, we are not going to go with it, is the Sinn Féin of Gerry Adams. And so in a poll of Irish political preferences taken Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of this past week, there was a complete upside-down turnabout in the political preferences of the Irish people caused by the support of the present ruling party and conditional support of other parties for this brutal package, the total opposition of Sinn Féin. So Sinn Féin rose in the poll from being the smallest party in Ireland to being the number three, I believe, three or four, but I think three, and the currently ruling party fell from being the strongest party in Ireland to being, I believe, the number four below Sinn Féin. This thing is going to be stopped in its tracks. I mean, the Inter Alpha Group is going to go bankrupt either way, regardless of how much people massacre themselves in order to prevent it. It's going to go under. The question is whether it's going to bring the rest of us down with it, or whether we're going to cut the ties, let it sink under the waves, and return to a Roosevelt-style American constitutional approach to economy and monetary system, beginning with the Glass-Steagall Law of Roosevelt, which separates investment banking from commercial banking, so preventing bankers from playing casino gambling games with our savings accounts, our checking accounts, and so forth. And the corollary of that, also introduced by Roosevelt, an international fixed exchange rate system, rather than the international system, which is supposed to be stable to allow international investment, being a day-to-day crap game of gambling on sinking and floating values of various currencies.
Right. And, Tony, this all throws the spotlight, if anyone needs it, on the nature of what you've seen, this deficit commission that by fiat Obama created. This week they said they couldn't get anywhere near a consensus vote. Okay, fine, on how to blood suck out of the United States. But it's the same as this memorandum of understanding that Inter Alpha wants exactly with the government of Ireland.
It's the same thing. I mean, and this Simpson-Bowles commission is, as Marcia said, appointed by Obama. They disregarded their whole presidential mandate. They didn't vote when they were supposed to vote in their mandate. They couldn't reach a recommendation. But what Simpson and Bowles said is, well, we can't get agreement, but who cares? We control the key people in the key congressional committees. We'll put it through anyway.
And I hear, and they either they said or Obama said, we're going to meet by the, we're going to continue on this? Out of the White House, I mean.
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that, and maybe I should reiterate here, Tony, you've been meeting with Mr. LaRouche along with other people that he has put out in the last 10 days. For example, people should look on the LaRouchePub.com where you're hearing this show, or LaRouchePAC.com, his political action committee. He's put it to the British. He wrote a thing on the death dance of the marionettes.
Yes.
That it's going to, the Inter-Alpha is blowing out, the whole system is blowing out anyway. We are looking at a dark age, and it's almost saying those in England who choose to want to participate in reorganization of the type you said.
Yeah,
you,
he's saying there's a future for Britain as a nation state. I mean, what Marsh says is absolutely true. We are entering a new dark age unless the present policy is dramatically and totally reversed within a very short time. We're in a new dark age of civilization, which will be unlike anything experienced back to the 14th century in Europe, where Europe lost a third of its population to the Black Death. But there are some people in Britain who say, well, we're not going to let this country go down with the Inter Alpha Group. We have a future as a British nation, not an empire, but a nation. And analogous to the to immediately after World War II, where they threw out Churchill, this great hero of certain Americans,
That's
substituted a different government, and went along with the process of economic reconstruction of Britain and Europe. And the same, I mean, an analogous kind of option is open to the British people today. We have nothing against the British people, but the empire headquartered in London is imminent, is doomed over the very short term.
okay, well, that seems to I would only I know it concludes the time period you have available to us today, which is good. And it does underscore what people can do. They can understand, make a big point of it, and activate. We're not lobbying Congress, that's for sure. But the venues around the country, you see it in states and localities for citizen leadership, it's completely wide open. And so I'll just thank Tony Papert,
Thank
who,
you, Marcia.
thank you very much, who gave us this update today, December 4th. And I'll be happy to get any emails in, but now we're going to go to a pre-taped session. And I'll just mention again, there's still the editors of EIR wrote the book on who the Inter Alpha Group is back in 1978 called Dope Inc. And there are still a few left, so I'm going to say you can call, don't even wait, but 800-278-3135. I'll repeat it if you now want to search for your pencil. That's to reach EIR by phone. You can go to the store on larouchepub.com, but it's 800-278-3135. Thanks. So now, as Tony leaves, we're going to switch to a report I mentioned that was done here in the studio by an Iowa activist farmer, Richard Baker, whom I'll introduce, and then any emails that come in, I'll be glad to answer them. It won't be on the air. Okay, this is the picture from the Farm Belt. So we're speaking today, it's December 2nd, 2010, near Washington, D.C., in our studio, with a guest from Iowa, Richard Baker. I welcome you, Dick.
Thank you, Marcia.
And I'm very glad Dick can be with us because he has a hardcore physical economic view of things. Iowa is one of the centers. California may be bigger, but Iowa is one of the centers of North America and farming. In fact, I think 90% of its land area is arable, potentially able to be cropped. There is no other state in the United States like it. And Dick is farms there. He farms alongside many family members, his son, his brothers and sisters, their ne ne nieces and nephews. And in addition, he has specialties where he places hogs, besides raising hogs and crops, corn, soybeans, places them for marketing from independent producers. And we're talking about operations of this extended friends and family in southeast Iowa. And I know we're talking many generations back, Dick. I can't say how many, but the forebears came from Germany before the Civil War to southeast Iowa.
Yes.
And so you have an historical perspective. I can just say one thing right at the beginning. The reason we have the same last name is Dick is my brother-in-law.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make him less authoritative or makes him special, of course, but Dick, in 1988, was involved in a special initiative called Food for Peace that formed that year. It was a big drought year, it hit Iowa very hard, but formed at the initiative of Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche, Lyndon LaRouche, because that was it was formed in Chicago as an actual organization, as a subgroup of the Schiller Institute internationally, to help pull together leaders in different countries around the world and North America on the food and farm question, because it was a namesake for the Food for Peace formed after the Second World War in the Franklin Delano Roosevelt tradition, where the idea was as U.S. policy should be to help other nations with their sovereignty, especially in food security. But that's 1988. You remember, Dick, in Chicago, the meeting.
Yeah, very well.
And there were people there, I'll just say in passing, from Australia, especially Europe, Central and South America, yeah. Canada. We could go into that, but and very active for 10 or 15 years. But instead, it's not as if they failed. The world did go into more and more globalization, North American free trade. And to fast forward to the present, we have a situation of potentially, unless we have internationally emergency measures, such as the Glass-Steagall approach to stopping the speculation, stopping this crazy globalization, and we need to restore nations that are otherwise facing, as you see in Ireland, being told, you're not going to exist, you have to give your blood and sweat and your firstborn to back up money to these zombie banks that just have conducted all these 30, 40, 50 years of speculation. So we have a potential food chain breakdown. We have 1 billion people, they estimate, that are truly without enough food. And the United States, look at the unemployed. Here we are the last month of this year, and you look at people, there is never, when it comes to food, people don't have the means to go and buy it. But Dick can give us a picture of don't count on it being produced if you don't do something about ending the speculation and putting in a credit system in the American tradition and launching, rebuilding the world, such as in our own continent to the North American Water and Power Alliance. So with that, Dick, if you were giving, well, you are giving a situation report, you could start anywhere about Iowa, the state of the countryside, the state of the youth, the children. What stands out in your mind?
Well, Marcia, keep in mind now, I'm new at this, so I'm speaking on a radio here that I'm kind of inexperienced. But as far as agriculture, I am experienced. And I think instead of starting right now, we need to start back in the 40s and the 50s.
Okay, good.
We need to bring the history up because people listening to this segment are probably a majority of them are withdrawn from agriculture because they've had so many segments of their family that they've moved away from agriculture. So let's start back in the 40s. Everybody knows that during the Depression that agriculture was hit very hard. Then we had Franklin Roosevelt who came on. He knew that we had to do something because we had to start up again, and he did it with programs. Do I understand all the programs? No, but you do, Marcia. And what that did was gave a base for us to truly feed and expand our the way we produce food, whether it be corn, soybeans, in the livestock, cattle, hogs, poultry, turkeys. Well, what ended up happening was that was a great thing. There was a parity program put in there. Farmers who was by the manys was able to, if they was already farming and had lost out, was able, because of the bad times, the depression, the economy, they was able to start up again. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was called parity pricing.
Yeah, in other words, that they actually legislated that there should be a floor. The price the farmer would get for his chickens or his corn or milk had to have a relationship to what he had to pay to produce it for the fertilizer or for the seeds or for the veterinary or something, and a little on top for a decent profit so he could educate the young farmers coming up in his family. So this was called parity. You're right. This was the big innovation by Franklin Roosevelt.
And what it did was, it did a lot of things. First one, it started farmers out where they felt safe at starting the farm. It gave their creditors the ability to say, yeah, we'll go with that. That's a good program. But it also multiplied the families in rural areas, which populated the schools, which populated the churches. We just had a good moral fabric going.
Institutions. Institutions. Had, shops, or I mean the town centers.
Yes, our towns and everything. And it went good. Farmers became technological experts through programs that companies would do because we knew we needed to produce more food. Okay, here we go. It grew, and it grew. Did the price of land really go extravagant? Absolutely not. We had farms in our areas that while the farmers knew they was going to make money, that was for sale for 3, 4, 5 years at a time. And the neighbors wasn't interested. They was happy in what they had. And they was able to raise their families, and it was a very good thing. A lot of people had, this might be a little bit wrong to say, but had decent-sized families. What it did to our school systems, just everything in the communities, prospered it. Okay. Then we got into that. We went through the 50s with that. I remember my dad. If you worked hard, you was going to do good. Then we got into the 60s. Same, basically the same thing. Technology's changed. You came out with the bigger machinery, which was good. We started creating glots of food, actually. That's what they called it. But if I remember right, our country was set up on a system that we was supposed to have so much grain in reserve in case we had crop failures. Okay? And we'll get back to that point as we move on through time.
Okay.
So, here we come. The farming was doing very good. We was producing cheap food for the American people. And while doing that, though, it got to a point where the parity pricing fell off.
They legislated it out.
They moved us into a free trade market that we had no security on what we was going to end up with our produce, swine, cattle, corn. But it took a long time for that to affect it. Let's say we go from the 60s to the mid-70s. There was things, I'm sure, in the background was being done to start controlling agriculture. We was never alert enough to see that because all we thought our jobs was to produce food. Farmers are supposed to produce food. Okay? So then we get into the 70s, and we start seeing land prices go up. Sometimes pretty high. I mean, if there was farms sold for $700-$800 an acre, so we lost it. We lost that ability where them farms, the farmers wasn't really. They didn't need more ground. They was doing fine where they was, and then we got into a spiel where through publications, through you've got to raise more food. In fact, I think, I forget the ag secretary, was it, back in the 70s, it said, tear out your fences, farm fence row to fence row. A lot of people caught up in that. And that's what they started doing. It started a fad where you just wanted to farm more and more. The programs led you to farm more and more. And ground got high. So in the late 70s, we was in that situation where ground had gotten fairly high. And like $2,000-$3,000 an acre, $2,500. And then the early 80s came and we went through a real tight spot. Economically, the whole world did. Interest went sky high. It was really hard, and it was hard on agriculture, but it was hard on everybody. I'm talking agriculture, but I'm really thinking of the whole economy. And the high interest put agriculture in a strain again. Blew out a few of them. They lost. They didn't have that support price in the parity pricing, which they didn't have. So we lost some farmers. The price of ground dropped. And then we went on to the 80s, and it kind of picked up a little bit better. But technology, if the people in this country should ever know anything, farmers are out here to feed people. And the technologies that companies have done for us in seed, in machinery, in everything, in livestock, we produce the ultimate best product that we can. Them technologies all cost money, but they all produced food galore. But then we seen the big companies, the Cargills, the AD&Ms, them type of companies come in and control more and more and more. I'm just going to pick on a couple of them. There was four or five, maybe more out there. What that did was starting to control agriculture from the price side. Okay? So here we are. We're raising phenomenal amount of corn, but we're truly not getting the price. If it wasn't for a farm program, we're truly not getting the price that we needed for that corn. Yeah, we was doing okay, but we wasn't the. It just wasn't in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s. It just didn't come out like it was supposed to, and pretty soon you started seeing young kids who normally would have been farmers graduate from the high schools and go to college. Probably because their dad said, in a lot of ways, not all of them, but a lot of them said, there's no way I'm going to be able to start you out with this here. Yeah, we've had a good run, but it just don't look good. So then we get up into the 80s where these farm programs actually, in not a good way, made farmers bigger. Because the ones that wanted to go with it, it made them bigger, and it took where we used to have a lot of farmers in a community.
So it's more concentrated.
More concentrated. Took many of the farmers out because their kids wasn't there to back them up anymore. And what I'm trying to say is, let's take a jump ahead. What it's actually done is made us. Corporations are running farms today. Not all, but to a big percent. And they're doing it with subsidies from farm programs, which didn't help. But it's almost like it was there to make it happen that way. If you go today and look back, it's almost like it was set in stone. Somebody knew that this could happen. And today, the price of land, phenomenal.
Just in the last
2-3 years. It's been growing up. It's been coming up. But where I said back in the late 70s, early 80s, $2,000 to $3,000 ground for good ground. Today, just last week, we had a farm bring $8,825 an acre. There is no way that they can justify buying that. Because there's no way that ground can produce itself unless the grain prices get sky high. The problem is that just as sure as corn goes up, everything it takes to raise that corn's going up too. So it don't matter if corn goes to $5.50, $6. Yeah, it's going to make food a lot higher. But for the profit margin for that farmer, it stays the same. It's always just a percentage. And so it's not helping it a bit. Not that the farmer has to get filthy rich on what he does. That's not what he wants. So actually, we've taken agriculture, they've taken agriculture and moved it to fewer people in corporate hands, corporate investment. Today, there's not a lot of family farmers buying ground. It's people that are afraid of what's coming in the economy down the road. They've got money, and they don't know where to put it.
Well, I saw the Kansas City Federal Reserve referring to what you're saying. They used their special Fed speak, and I think they said last week, it's because investors don't have other sure opportunities on the usual speculative markets. They mean speculators. They meant hot money and syndicates of people coming into Iowa. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing that and bidding up farmland.
What I'm actually saying, whenever I say corporates, I'm not saying so much investors coming in or speculators coming in. What I'm saying is it's people that are outside the realm of agriculture that could have been raised in agriculture at one time, but instead they got into construction or they got into something else. They went to college, they got great jobs, had great jobs, and now they're sitting on money that they don't know what to do with because they don't want to invest it in Wall Street anymore.
Yeah.
So they got the money, and I understand it. What are you invested in? Gold, ground, something that you can hold on to. That's what's happening now. But in truth, it's shutting down agriculture.
That's it.
A lot of people don't see that, but it's shutting down the potential to keep our young farmers or just farmers in general on the majority in agriculture. And whenever you do that, then you shut down communities. What it'll also do, it'll make the price of food high. It's going to happen. They can't stop it because it will be controlled by fewer hands who have much more control over the whole picture. I don't know if I did this right or not, Marcia.
Well, the picture you paint is perfectly clear. Let me ask you one other thing.
Okay.
Because you mentioned, made it clear about, say, someone who might be mostly producing corn. But, of course, for corn as livestock feed or someone trying to maintain a dairy herd, someone trying to, you're getting chain reactions of boomerang effects. Mm-hmm. So you don't have any stability or security. You touched on that. Do you want to say more about it?
Sure.
From season to season.
Back in 40s and 50s and 60s, if the price of corn moved 10 cents in 3 months, 2 months, that was a big move. And you just said it about the stability and safety and market prices. We have none anymore because Wall Street runs the markets. It truly does. And whenever you see corn go from $3.60 a bushel, which it was in August, I believe, and you watch it go to almost $6 a bushel, boom, in a month. What that does, why it really hurts the food chain is because, believe me, the people out here are eating pork, beef, and chicken. It's the best source of protein they can have. Forget anything else. But it throws the livestock industry in such a tantrum because the speculators are raising the price of it. It's not a true, how do I want to say this?
It's not a benefit.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, right.
It's not a true supply and demand. They're speculating the market, and they're taking every producer out there in agriculture with them, right or wrong. And our laws should not let them do that. In fact, I think the laws are set up that they cannot do it, but they've never been enforced. That's why we ran into our real estate bubble problem several years ago. It's going to happen again if they keep letting the funds traders, what they call them, corporations who have absolutely nothing to do. They don't care about agriculture. They just want to make a profit every day speculating somehow. And they're really ruining the base of agriculture in the long run. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Yeah, and people might want to know, you don't, I mean, it's out there, but you don't always look for it. It certainly isn't reported on the daily business news, such things as the following. I think in the last couple years, like last year, for dairy farmers, the milk price was below, significantly below their cost of maintaining these herds for at least 10 out of 12 months. And over a course of a half a generation or a farm, you might get a bad year or two. It may be in the past it was because of either drought or floods or...
Exactly.
But in this case, it's because of this completely wild speculation. Now it's kind of the end phase of speculation internationally. It isn't even just a little bit of something bad. Mm-hmm. This thing is cracking up. And you're so... That's dairy farms. You want, in particular, you're a specialist in hogs. It's not there again. What about the price swings you've seen from the point of view of instability? Say even from a young farmer trying to get in somewhere, the thing is impossible.
It would be almost impossible for a young farmer to get in, and I'll tell you why. Unless his father comes from the farm, runs a farm, and is willing to get behind him at a big risk. Some of them are doing it, but very few. Today, it would be almost virtually impossible. Financially, it would be impossible. What we've watched pork production do is go to corporate levels where... you don't have near the producers in the industry you had 10, 15, 20 years ago. They've gotten bigger.
Well, I think on a planetary level, you're right to bring, I think something like the famous name in the United States, but internationally is Smithfield. It's based in Virginia. Mm-hmm. But I think that whereas for decades, Iowa was a leader in both corn, along with Illinois, mm-hmm. and hogs, besides shell eggs and other things. But Smithfield turned North Carolina into a world hog concentration center, so it has almost as many hogs as Iowa. And I think the feed is brought in from Brazil. Smithfield built a port in Wilmington, North Carolina, owns mm-hmm. the port, you know. It's so, mm-hmm. But you're seeing even in Iowa, which was family farms, hog farmers at some point, where you have the big operations, corporate, not just larger family farms, but actual corporate.
Actually, corporate, they are larger family farmers on a corporate basis. They've no different than I said before. There is more ground, fewer producers farming the ground, more acres of the ground going under corporations. Some of them could be family corporations. Most of them probably are. But it's the sign of the times that it should have never got pushed. It should have never been had to get pushed to that. It's the old saying we come out, I truly believe this, that if there's something that an establishment wants to make a move on, they're going to publicize it. And if they publicize it enough, they're going to get people to think that's true. And a good example is that 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago maybe, it came out that if you're going to be a pork producer, you probably have to raise more numbers, because it could get to where you could only maybe make a dollar a head. That was on the radios, it was on the papers, it was all the experts said that. And actually moved pork production that way. They did. Now, corporations did come in and do that. Smithfield's, I'm not going to put Smithfield down. I'm also a marketing agent for a company that supplies a lot of hogs to Harvest. We call it Harvest.
Oh, yeah?
We have to have the packing houses. We have to have the packing houses. What I would say is that Smithfield should have never had the ability to get as big as they was in the production of
the hogs. In the actual producing
rules
animals.
Rules was not followed.
No, that's
again
true.
Overlooked. Okay? And that basically took the family farmer out. In the big picture, and I know we can sit here and talk about this more and more, but in the big picture, your family farms was the ones that had the ability to produce. They was the ones that had the enthusiasm to produce more and more and more. because that's what we've trained. We're supposed to feed the people of the world. And corporations are not necessarily that way.
Yeah, that's true, too. And speaking of that, I think that you even have this intercontinental or continental scale. Here's what you have to do to get with the program. Exactly. You have some of your Iowa young people farming 6 months in Iowa and then going down to Brazil, I've heard, farming.
Yes, we got that. Yeah, we got that. I'm not. It's not a put down. I'm not going to put them down. It's kind of.
You mean
like,
for not? They're industrious.
Yeah, they're industrious. I don't have that kind of energy anymore. But will that work? It'll work for a while, but it's not going to work forever. And I think I've kind of said it here, Marcia. I don't know.
No, I know it's not a good. But to conclude, I guess. The other thing is you've given a sweep of history, which really puts it in perspective. But it's like you said, how long? When is it not going to work? If you have chain reaction effects of blowouts of non-payment, you know, I mean, we see it in the headlines in the forms. It's just like the banks wanting to be bailed out, and people have to give up their have their government shut down, have local. It's certainly the case that we're on in the phase where that can mean the deliveries aren't made or something's critical in the cycle of nature. If you don't have the fertilizer, exactly. If you don't have the gas at the right time, if you can't transport. So it's not even, it's even in the next, each growing season can't be taken for granted.
Each growing season. And I think I fell back on that. Back in the older, earlier years, our government made sure we had so much grain in storage.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think they call that the ever-normal granary under FDR. There
yes.
was a name for that, that you'd always keep a certain level in reserve.
Yeah, and that continued clear up into the 70s, but then all of a sudden that was gone. And we came out with a grain report. I'll give you the example in August where we was only going to have 1 point. We was only going to have 36 or 45 days
okay.
of grain if we had a crop failure. Now, if I was a government official, I would say, we can't do that. First of all, it would break agriculture. Secondly, it would make our, because people, food is the most important thing this country can have. And this world needs food. And the United States is one of the, that's what we do. It's our main export. And, but if you let that fall into corporate hands, it's altogether different. Corporates look at it as money. They don't look at it as food. The young farmers, the family farmers look at it as food. We're doing our job. Yes, we want to make money, but we're doing our job. We'll take a loss once in a while, but let's don't let it be because of speculation on the Board of Trade. At the same time, I think they have to get farm programs out of it. I really do. There is some farm programs that are good. Young Farmers Program, very good. They need to create a program where, just as sure as I said agriculture lands high, there is a lot of people with old farmers, retired farmers with this land, not necessarily retired neither, but they need to give them a reason why they, instead of going out and charging somebody high-priced cash rent, they need to give them a reason to start out a young farmer. It might be in tax breaks, whatever it might be. There is programs that need to be out there and enforced, but the ones that they got today just make these corporate farmers get bigger because basically they're farming for farm programs. The money that's the government's throwing into them, that has to be switched. That money, if the government's going to throw money in, let's throw it into a purpose where we start the young family farmers, at least try to start them back out again and use the old farmers' money in their land to do that.
And to help direct help. To the benefit.
Yes, yes.
Instead of just languish. Well, of course, what you describe is these, there's the beneficial programs, but then other programs in the last 20, 30 years went along with the North American Free Trade Agreement and the globalization in Washington and the big influence of Cargill and ADM. It was part of the, it was written into the World Trade Organization that was set up in the 90s. That nations shouldn't have these food reserves you talked about because they, their excuse was, you know, it was trade distorting, all this garbage. But in fact, what you say, too, about it, you could take the what serves a public good about bringing in more farmers, young farmers getting started, would is certainly the... what could go along with launching large infrastructure building programs, you know, where you train people on construction, and the days you could first start to bring online new agriculture or new potential for irrigation, like in the high, dry plains. This certainly would be, it's like the old Homestead Act of 160 acres. You could have a start off of farmers with something like the North American Water and Power Lines being
the WAPA. Exactly. Exactly. There's programs out there that can make this work, and it's not only going to make it work to produce food, it's going to make it work to build economies, to get people back in jobs. The big thing is to make our small towns grow instead of having everybody move to the big cities, which is not good. Let's make our small towns grow, our schools, our businesses, but we have to have populations out of the out in them farms. Now, in our area, we're not as bad because we still got that old depth family history, but in a lot of areas, that's gone. So, or leaving, maybe not gone, but leaving, and could get, and could be brought back real quick with the right proposals. And I'm not saying throw money at them. I'm saying make it work for the people of the United States, make it work for the farmers of the United States, and make it work for the family, the farm families, which would automatically, naturally boil into every kind of population there is in the United States. Okay?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Marcia.
But I have one addendum that Iowa is also the world center. I just looked up the figures, along with Illinois, Minnesota, southern Minnesota, of the biofuel system.
Okay.
In other words, nearing 40% of U.S. corn is going into the, blending into gasoline. And speaking, you were just speaking about building the economy. This is actually, even if you do a good job technically of selling the distiller's grain so it can be livestock feed and make every... Instead of going nuclear, so we have plenty of electricity for the next platform of potential productivity, we're just it's like seeing it burn away. But you've seen Iowa transformed in your own lifetime.
I've seen. If we got time, we'll visit a little bit about the ethanol. Farmers never would have dreamed 30 years ago that they're. Their grains would be put into gas, fuel. Today, I still believe it shouldn't be done. We've got so many people in this world that we could supply. Don't get me wrong, it'd be an international thing. Not just the United States. We don't have to feed everybody in the world. The whole world can come in and make plans and we do it. But whenever the ethanol thing came out, there's no doubt in my mind that anybody with any kind of vision at all would have to know that this is too good to be true.
Okay.
Let's go this way. First of all, our government says we're going to subsidize the people who make the ethanol plants. Okay? Sounds great. My guess is that a lot of the lobbying money that pushed for this was big grain companies. Because in the long run, they already know that corn is not the ethical thing to use to make ethanol. They already knew that. They just used it. Boy, it sure did make farmers think that their corn was going to be worth a lot. Okay? In the backhaul, it's going to get so high, it's almost like they wanted people to invest in ethanol plants, whoever they are. Forget.
Right. No, it's called a boom. That's okay.
They wanted to invest. They wanted other people to invest money in the state-of-the-art ethanol plants. And as soon as they drop the subsidies, they're going to go broke. And you will, somebody will be there buying state-of-the-art, brand-new ethanol plants that somebody else put their money into for 10 cents, 20 cents on the dollar. And then they will, but they're not going to use corn because it's not ethically right to use it unless you give them subsidies for it. And I think the subsidies are about ready to burn out. So I don't know if that made sense.
Well, all you have is a picture of destruction instead of...
of agriculture, yeah. Or get it in smaller hands. And whenever you say get it in smaller hands, you're talking corporations. So.
Well, we can leave that. It certainly shows we should. We have a job in our hands to change gears very fast, which is the whole point, or we're not going to be able to eat.
Yes, yes.
Thank you, Dick Baker.
Thank you, Marcia.
And thanks to everyone. This is the end of the LaRouche Show for December 4th, 2010. This is Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you.